All right, let's dive into this, huh? The future of the Australian Defence Force, the ADF. You've really given us quite the reading list here.
Yeah.
Excerpts from Robin Laird's book, the one on ADF modernization, some transcripts, looks like a Sir Richard Williams Foundation seminar, and even some recent articles all about defense.
A lot of material.
It seems like you really want to get a handle on how the ADF is, preparing for this world, one that's changing, what, faster than ever?
It is, and it's a really important question, especially I think considering, how things are shifting globally. We've gone from, I guess, a period of relative peace to this intense great power competition. And the Indo-Pacific region, I mean, that's becoming a real focal point for a lot of these tensions.
It's a lot to think about all at once. One thing, though, that really stood out from Laird's book was I don't know if chilling is the right word, but the fact that the PLA could have bombers, approaching the Australian coast in what was it, 5.5 hours?
Yeah, 5.5
I mean,
hours.
that really puts things in perspective.
It does. I mean, completely dismantles that old assumption of, we've got 10 years to get ready. You
Right.
know, that comfortable buffer that Australia used to rely on, it's gone.
Poof.
Yeah, it's just a stark reminder that the ADF, they can't afford to be complacent. It's
Right.
got to be ready for anything and fast.
5.5 hours. I mean, that's barely enough time to finish a good podcast, let alone prepare for some kind of conflict. So, how is the ADF responding to this new reality? What are they actually doing to make sure they're ready for whatever might come their way?
Well, they're tackling this massive change, right, on three fronts: restructuring, readiness, and resilience. Laird, he calls these the quote-unquote three R's of ADF modernization.
Okay, three R's. I like that. Catchy, and it sort of breaks down this complex challenge, into something we can maybe get our heads around.
Yeah.
But what does it actually mean, practically? Let's go through these R's one by one, starting with restructuring. What kind of changes are we talking about?
Restructuring. It really involves, a complete overhaul, really, of the ADF's force design. It means adopting new technologies, especially autonomous systems,
Right.
those unmanned vehicles and platforms that everyone's talking about these days, changing how we think about warfare.
Yeah.
But it's not just about, bringing in the shiny new toys. It's about figuring out how to integrate those seamlessly with existing forces.
So it sounds like they're trying to build a more agile and flexible force,
Right.
one that can adapt to a wider range of threats,
Exactly.
wider range of
A
scenarios.
wider range of contingencies for sure.
Okay, wider range of
Yeah.
contingencies. So what about readiness? How are they ensuring their forces are prepared for this this more complex and unpredictable world?
Well, readiness is, it's all about training and preparation. It's about making sure that the ADF has the equipment and the training, really, to handle a much broader spectrum. A much broader spectrum of contingencies. I mean, think about it. They need to be ready for anything, from traditional combat operations to humanitarian assistance to disaster relief and even cyber warfare.
So it's not just about being prepared for a fight.
No.
It's about being ready for anything and everything.
Exactly.
Sounds like a massive undertaking, especially, given the limited resources of a medium-sized force like the ADF.
Right.
And that's why this third R, resilience, that's why that's so crucial. And
Yes.
resilience, this one sounds, I don't know, particularly important in a world where threats can come from anywhere at any time.
Right.
What does this mean for the ADF? What does resilience look like for them?
It's really about the ADF's ability to withstand and recover from attacks, not just in the, physical realm, but also in the cyber and space domains. So, think about protecting critical infrastructure, securing communication networks, and ensuring that operations can continue even under pressure.
So it's about being able to bounce back, basically.
Yeah.
Bounce back from a punch, keep fighting even when things get tough. Seems like a pretty critical capability in this era of, what do they call it, hybrid warfare, where the lines between, traditional combat and other forms of conflict, they're getting blurrier and blurrier.
Exactly. And one thing Laird really emphasizes is, the ADF can't just focus on building this future force. They have to kind of upgrade their current capabilities on the fly, so to speak. They need to make sure that they're relevant and lethal today, even while they're preparing for the challenges of tomorrow.
It makes sense. You can't can't just put everything on hold while you wait for the fancy new tech to arrive. You have to make the most of what you have right now. But how do they do that? How do they balance the need to modernize with the need to maintain, you know, a credible defense force today?
Well, that's where partnerships come in. Both Laird's book and the seminar transcripts you made, they constantly highlight how crucial collaboration is for the ADF.
Hmm.
We're talking partnerships, you know, within the ADF itself,
right,
between the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and critically partnerships with allies like the US and the UK.
It seems like no one can really go it alone anymore.
And
in modern defense, everyone needs to work together to pool resources, share expertise, and present this united front.
Right.
But what does that actually look like? I mean, in practice, what are some concrete examples of these partnerships, you know, at play?
Well, the seminar transcripts actually provide some great insights into that. We see, you know, joint exercises like Talisman Sabre, where Australian and U.S. forces, they train together, they're developing interoperability, and they're testing their ability to operate as a cohesive unit.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of focus on technology sharing.
Okay.
For example, Australia is collaborating with the U.S. on developing hypersonic missiles.
So it's about sharing the burden, basically,
yeah,
and leveraging each other's strengths to create a more powerful and effective force. Makes a lot of sense strategically. But how does a, you know, medium-sized force like the ADF, how do they maximize their impact in a region as vast and challenging as the Indo-Pacific? How do they punch above their weight, so to speak?
Well, that's where the concept of kill web maneuver forces comes into play.
Ooh, kill web maneuver forces.
Yeah.
Now that sounds intriguing and maybe a little intimidating.
A little bit.
Can you break that down for us? What does that actually mean, and why is it so crucial for the ADF's future?
This is a critical concept to grasp, because it directly addresses your concern about how, you know, a smaller force can effectively deter a larger adversary like China.
Okay.
It's about moving away from that traditional, what we call platform-centric approach to warfare,
mm-hmm,
where you focus on, you know, individual ships, planes, and tanks.
So it's not about having the biggest and most expensive toys anymore.
Exactly. The kill web concept, it's about creating a networked and agile force.
Okay.
That can outmaneuver and overwhelm adversaries,
mm-hmm,
regardless of their size. Think of it as a spider web, where each strand represents a different capability.
Mm-hmm.
Air, land, sea, cyber, space.
Okay, I'm starting to see the picture. So instead of relying on brute force, the ADF is aiming for a more strategic, interconnected approach. They're weaving this web of capabilities that can trap and neutralize their opponents. But how do they build this web? What are the key elements that make it work?
Well, the web, it's woven really from this combination of advanced technologies, clever strategies, and crucially, the human element. But before we get into, you know, the specifics, let's connect this back to something we were talking about earlier, partnerships. Remember how we discussed the ADF collaborating with their allies?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like those partnerships are essential, not just for sharing resources, but for actually making this kill web concept, you know, for making it work.
Exactly. You can't really have a web without connections.
Yeah. Right?
And those connections extend beyond just military hardware. It's,
yeah,
it's about integrating, you know, everything, intelligence sharing, logistics support, even leveraging civilian assets.
And that's where this idea of a national air power enterprise comes in, right? I remember that being a key theme in the seminar transcript.
Yeah.
It sounded like, I don't know, it sounded like a pretty radical idea, looking beyond the traditional boundaries of the Air Force, to create a more comprehensive and resilient air power capability.
It is a significant shift in thinking.
Mm.
It recognizes that air power isn't just about the aircraft themselves, it's about the entire ecosystem that supports them.
Right.
Infrastructure, logistics, personnel, training, maintenance. I mean, even things like air traffic control and weather forecasting.
So it's about harnessing the full potential, really, of air power by tapping into a much broader range of resources and expertise, including those from the civilian sector. But why is this so crucial for Australia specifically?
Well, you know, as Chris McGinnis, he's the Executive Director of the Air Power Institute, you know, as he pointed out in seminar, Australia, they're incredibly reliant on aviation both for their economy and their defense. I mean, think about their geography, you know, a vast island nation with a very, very dispersed population. Air power is essential for connecting everything and everyone.
It's their lifeline, really. But if that 10-year warning time, if that's gone, and Australia's air superiority is under threat, how does this national air power enterprise concept, how does that actually address that challenge? It sounds very abstract.
It's about recognizing that defending Australia's airspace, it's not solely the RAAF's responsibility anymore. It requires contributions from the entire aviation sector, commercial airlines, training organizations, maintenance and repair facilities, research institutions. I mean, the whole lot.
So they're essentially creating a more robust and adaptable air power capability by bringing together the strengths of both the military and civilian aviation sectors. It's like a network of interconnected capabilities, you know, all working together to ensure Australia's air superiority, both in peacetime and crucially in conflict.
Exactly. And this interconnectedness isn't limited to just the air domain. Remember Jennifer Parker's presentation on the changing literal environment from the seminar transcripts.
Yeah, she painted I don't know, a rather concerning picture, really, of the growing threat posed by adversary submarines, particularly in the water surrounding Australia. It sounded like a whole new dimension of warfare that Australia needs to prepare for.
You're catching on quickly. And her analysis, it really emphasized the need for a defense in depth approach to counter that submarine threat. Australia needs a layered and resilient maritime defense, one that utilizes a combination of manned and unmanned platforms, both surface and subsurface, to protect its maritime approaches.
So it's not just about having, you know, bigger and better warships. It's
Sure.
about creating that same kind of interconnected network we talked about in the air, but underwater, a network that can detect, track, and engage the submarines before they can pose a threat to Australia's security.
You got it. And just like in the air, autonomous systems, they play a crucial role in this maritime defense in depth strategy. We've already talked about the Ghost Shark, that extra large autonomous underwater vehicle. But what about unmanned surface vessels? Do they have a role to play in this as well?
They must, right? I mean, if you're talking about creating a truly comprehensive maritime defense network, it would make sense to have unmanned systems operating both above and below the surface.
Exactly. One of the defense articles you shared, it discusses a recent trial by the Royal Australian Navy. They successfully integrated autonomous systems into a decommissioned patrol boat, essentially turning it into an unmanned surface vessel.
So they're experimenting with using these unmanned vessels to enhance their maritime surveillance and patrol capabilities.
Precisely. And this trial, it wasn't just about testing the technology itself.
Right.
It was about developing the operational concepts and the procedures for integrating these unmanned vessels into the Navy's existing fleet.
It seems like the ADF is taking a very deliberate and methodical approach to incorporating autonomous systems. They're not just, you know, jumping on the latest tech bandwagon. They're carefully considering how these systems can best enhance their existing capabilities and developing the doctrine and the training to support their effective use. It's not just about the tech, it's about the people using it.
You're absolutely right, and that focus on developing the human element alongside the technology, I mean, that's absolutely crucial for the success of these modernization efforts. As we discussed earlier, even with the most advanced autonomous systems, I mean, human beings, they're still the ones making the critical decisions.
Yeah, it's about finding that sweet spot, that right balance between human expertise and technological capability, recognizing that each has its strengths and limitations. But all this talk of cutting-edge tech, new strategies, shifting doctrines, it all sounds very, very expensive.
And you'd be right to point that out.
Yeah.
All of this modernization, I mean, it requires a serious financial commitment, which brings us to another key theme that that emerged from the sources, the need for a more agile and adaptable acquisition process.
That makes sense. The traditional, you know, platform-centric approach to acquisition, it can be incredibly slow and cumbersome, especially in a world where technology is evolving at such a rapid pace. If the ADF is going to keep up, they need to be able to acquire and integrate new technologies much faster.
Precisely. Several of the experts in the sources, they highlighted the need for a more flexible and responsive acquisition system, one that can quickly adapt to emerging threats and incorporate new technologies as they become available.
So are they suggesting a complete overhaul of the way the ADF buys its equipment?
It's more about a shift in mindset, I think. Both within the ADF and the defense industry, they need to move away from the idea of acquiring large complex platforms with decades long lifespans, and instead focus on smaller, more modular systems that can be rapidly upgraded and adapted as technology advances.
It sounds like they're talking about embracing a more iterative approach, similar to how tech companies operate, constantly updating and improving their systems rather than waiting for the next, you know, big expensive platform to come along.
You got it. And that shift requires a change in culture. They need to be more open to innovation,
oh.
You know, accept a certain level of risk and be willing to experiment with new approaches.
Essentially, they need to become more comfortable with failing fast and learning from their mistakes. It's a big ask for a large bureaucratic organization like the ADF.
You're right. It's a huge challenge. But the sources they suggest that the future of the ADF and indeed the future of defense in general, it depends on their ability to adapt, to innovate, and to think outside those traditional paradigms.
It's about recognizing that the world is changing at an unprecedented pace, and the threats we face are becoming increasingly complex and unpredictable. The old ways of doing things, they just won't cut it anymore.
Absolutely. And to meet these challenges head on, they need to be willing to embrace new ideas, new technologies, and fundamentally new ways of thinking about defense.
It's a tall order, but it seems like the ADF is on the right track, at least based on the information we've been diving into.
They are showing promising signs.
Hmm.
And one of the most encouraging aspects is their willingness to learn from others, both from their allies and importantly from their adversaries.
That's an interesting point. It seems like they're adopting a more humble approach, acknowledging that they don't have all the answers, and that they can learn valuable lessons from anyone, even their opponents.
Exactly. No one has a monopoly on good ideas, especially in a rapidly evolving security environment like the one we're in now. It's essential to be constantly learning and adapting, drawing insights from wherever you can find them.
And the ADF has shown a willingness to embrace new concepts and technologies, experiment with new approaches, and crucially learn from the experiences of others, both good and bad. It's that adaptability that's going to be key to their success in this complex and challenging world.
Couldn't agree more. It's a constant process of learning, adapting, and innovating. Defense, it isn't a destination.
Right.
It's a journey.
Well said. This has been an incredibly insightful deep dive so far. We've explored the ADF's ambitious modernization efforts from the changing strategic landscape to those fascinating kill webs and the crucial role of partnerships. And we've seen how the ADF is rethinking its approach to everything, from acquiring new technology to embracing the contributions of civilian partners. It's clear that they're in the midst of a profound transformation.
And that transformation, it's about so much more than just acquiring new platforms. It's about embracing new concepts, new technologies, and fundamentally new ways of thinking about defense in the 21st century.
It's a truly fascinating journey, and one that we'll undoubtedly continue to follow closely. But for now, let's take a moment to gather our thoughts. We'll be back shortly to wrap up our deep dive into the future of the Australian Defence Force, and explore what all of this means for you.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive, really exploring how the ADF is evolving to meet the challenges of, well, you know, a rapidly changing world. It's clear they're focusing on interconnectedness, adaptability, leveraging every resource available. But there's one, I don't know, one piece of the puzzle we haven't fully explored, and that's the increasing emphasis on long-range strike capabilities.
Yeah, that's a sharp observation, and it's a crucial element of the ADF's modernization efforts. You see, the ability to project power at a distance, it's becoming, I mean, absolutely essential in this era of great power competition. It's no longer enough to just defend your own territory. You need to be able to deter potential adversaries by demonstrating your ability to strike back, and strike back hard.
One of the articles you shared, it really drove this point home. It talked about the ADF investing, I mean, a staggering $27 billion in 12 new families of long-range missiles by 2034.
Yeah.
With another $21 billion going towards domestic manufacturing. I mean, those are some serious numbers. It seems like they're really putting their money where their mouth is on this long-range strike strategy.
Yes, those figures, they're a clear indication of how seriously the ADF is taking this capability. This isn't just about, you know, acquiring new weapons. It's about a fundamental shift, really, in Australia's defense posture. They're moving away from that traditional balanced force structure.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a more integrated force, one that can deny adversaries access to Australia's strategic approaches.
So it's much more, I guess, a much more proactive approach to defense, based on deterrence through denial. Essentially, they're saying, you know, don't even think about messing with us because we can hit you back, and we can hit you hard no matter where you are.
Exactly, and that's where the kill web concept we've been discussing it really comes into its own. Long range strike capabilities, they're a key element of that web.
It's all starting to connect now. They're creating this multi-layered defense network that can respond to threats from any direction at any time. They have their eyes on the skies, the seas, cyberspace, and now they're extending their reach with these long-range missiles, creating a truly formidable deterrent force.
And that network, it'll include everything from, you know, those advanced radar, long-range surveillance aircraft we talked about earlier, to submarines armed with cruise missiles and land-based mobile missile launchers. It's a comprehensive system, really designed to detect, track, and if necessary, engage targets at extended ranges.
But wouldn't this kind of long-range strike capability, I mean, wouldn't that raise some serious, I don't know, ethical and diplomatic concerns? I mean, if you're talking about hitting targets, you know, potentially thousands of kilometers away, how do you ensure you're hitting the right targets and minimizing civilian casualties, and wouldn't this kind of aggressive posture, wouldn't that risk escalating tensions with potential adversaries?
You've raised some incredibly important questions, and the article you shared, it actually addresses those concerns head on. It highlights the absolute necessity, really, for a sophisticated defense targeting enterprise within the ADF. This goes far beyond just having, you know, fancy missiles.
So what is this defense targeting enterprise? What does it actually entail?
It's about developing the systems, the processes, and crucially the ethical framework to ensure that any use of long range strike capabilities is conducted with the utmost precision and accountability. They need to accurately identify and track targets, assess potential collateral damage, and guarantee that any strikes are conducted in full accordance with international law and, of course, Australia's strategic objectives.
It sounds like they're talking about a whole new level of responsibility when it comes to military operations. It's not just about having the capability to strike. It's about about having the wisdom and the restraint to use that capability judiciously and ethically.
Precisely. And this shift requires not just, you know, technological advancements, but a fundamental change in mindset within the ADF. It's about recognizing the immense responsibility that comes with wielding such powerful long range strike capabilities, and ensuring that those capabilities are used in a way that enhances, not undermines, Australia's security and standing in the world.
But wouldn't this also require a more proactive and strategic approach to diplomacy if Australia is going to project power in this way? I mean, wouldn't they need to be much, much clearer and more assertive in communicating their intentions to potential adversaries?
You're absolutely right. It's a delicate balancing act. On the one hand, they need to send a clear message of deterrence, making it crystal clear to any potential adversary that any attempt to threaten Australia's interests will be met with a swift and decisive response.
But on the other hand, you know, they can't appear overly aggressive or provocative. They need to leave room for dialogue and diplomacy to avoid unnecessarily escalating tensions.
Exactly. And as you can imagine, finding that balance is no easy feat. But it's essential for Australia to navigate this new era of great power competition effectively. They need to be both strong and responsible, capable of defending their interests while also working towards a more stable and peaceful regional order.
This entire deep dive, this has been incredibly, incredibly eye-opening. We've explored the changing strategic landscape, the ADF's ambitious modernization efforts, and the key themes that have emerged from our analysis of the source material you provided. We've delved into everything from cutting edge autonomous systems and long range strike capabilities to the importance of partnerships and a whole of nation approach to defense.
The sources, they really paint a picture of an organization that's embracing new ideas, experimenting with new technologies and adapting its strategies to meet the challenges of the 21st century. It's a fascinating journey, and one that I'm sure we'll both continue to follow with great interest.
Absolutely. And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to encourage you to reflect on the insights we've discussed today. Consider the implications of these changes for Australia's future, and engage in the ongoing conversation about the role of defense in this rapidly changing world. Thank you for joining us on this journey into the future of the Australian Defence Force.